All right, now let's see if this is recording. Yes, it is recording. Very well. This is tape number two of an interview between Dr. Eccles of the History Department and Dean Andre A. Potter of Purdue. This is recorded for the archives of Purdue University. We are discussing Dean Potter's career and ideas. Tape number two starts with the chronologically with the service of Dean A. Potter during and at the end of World War I. Dean Potter, you what did you do specifically in the World War I? Besides
my function was to organize and to start to encourage and organize the engineering colleges of the country to develop programs in order to increase the number of technicians needed, not so much technicians as people in the skilled trades, starting from well drillers to welders and horseshoers and cabinet makers and electricians and all types of technicians. And we
English would call an artificer.
Ah, yes.
So that we could have these men serve in war plants and shipyards.
And they needed so many of those types, and we were short. We were dependent entirely for our supply of skilled personnel on continental Europe, the Scandinavian countries, the British Isles, and to some extent, a much lesser extent, on countries like Italy. Of course, that supply stopped when the First World War started. And we found ourselves with the need of tens of thousands of those people. And my job was to organize, to encourage the engineering colleges to realize that it's their duty not only to educate engineers and to develop new knowledge in that field, but also to be sure that we have an adequate supply of skilled tradesmen who could do the things that are absolutely necessary in the Department of Defense. At that time it was called the War Department and the Navy Department, and also in the industries that serve those departments.
Now, yesterday you said that one of the good outcomes of your service was the helping to establish the vocational training in high schools, the Smith-Hughes Act, and then you said that the educators, in your opinion, principals and others in charge of it, had sort of killed it, that it hadn't worked well.
You understood me correctly. I feel that the starting with the superintendents of public schools and through the principals, who had absolutely no understanding of what a skilled workman does, just did not develop it, and it hasn't amounted much. Of course, in the Second World War, or going on with that, the big scarcity was in supporting personnel. People who can work as assistants to engineers and to mathematicians and to physicists and chemists. And
did we have enough men like tool and die makers in World War II?
I wouldn't say enough, but it wasn't so serious. It's an area of skilled personnel. And we set up the war training program, which was originally called EDT, Engineering Defense Training. Then we enlarged it to Engineering science management training.
What was your position in ESMWT?
I planned it. I went to see Admiral Nimitz and some of the top officers in the Army, and to try to find out what we needed. We needed a large number of draftsmen. We needed inspectors. We needed tens of thousands of inspectors. And I told them that they wanted to know whether there would be any way for the education, for the engineering colleges to speed up the program of education so that we could have a bigger supply of engineers. I told them we could speed up some by changing our year from the semester plan to a trimester plan. We could save probably a year. And most of the institutions changed to the trimester plan, but I told them that it isn't necessary for a person to have even an undergraduate program in engineering, that we can train testers, inspectors, draftsmen, all kinds of those sub-professional personnel in periods of probably 3 months, 10 weeks, 3 months. I also felt at the same time, I told my own observation is, that we lacked on the very highest level of scientific personnel, particularly in mathematics. In talking to General Bradley and to Admiral Nimitz and to the other top people in the Army and Navy whom I knew very well, I felt one of the greatest needs is to have people who are better prepared in higher mathematics than the PhDs of mathematics. And I met some time ago a professor at Brown University by the name of Richardson. And he impressed me on having a very clear idea of the importance of very advanced mathematics in certain areas. And in spite of the criticism thrown at me by a number of people, I arranged to give Professor Richardson, who was then Dean of the School of Science at Brown and Professor of Mathematics, a very substantial sum to set up a very advanced program in mathematics. And people thought that should have gone to institutions like MIT or Caltech or California or places like that. But I found there in Richardson an individual who had a vision, an idea. And he brought together people, most of them from this country, some from abroad, and we had a wonderful program. We also had some so-called refresher courses for engineers in industry.
I was part of that program at the Ohio University in Athens, Ohio.
Now, for instance, we trained 1,600,000 people through that program at a very insignificant cost. And the institutions, as a result of that, saw the importance of supporting personnel. And the so-called technical institute programs have grown in a very interesting way, although not fast enough. Because for every engineer, the industry needs at least 3 or 4 technicians. That sort of thing had been realized in Europe for 100 years or more. In 1924, when I was president of the Society for Promotion of Engineering Education, now called the American Society for Engineering Education, we had Wickenden and Hammond, two very interesting members of the engineering profession. Wickenden was in a top position with the American Telephone and Telegraph Company. Later on, after he was through with his work in preparing that report, was made president of Case School of Applied Science at Cleveland, Ohio. Now, Wickenden went to Europe and spent several months in Europe and came back. He felt that the programs for the training of supporting personnel called in Germany Mitweide and different other companies, technicums, and things of that sort, were something that that this country needs. In Europe, they had supporting personnel even in the field of medicine, in commerce. In medicine, if a child took sick in most of the European countries, they didn't call the MD, they called the technician, the medical technician. And the medical technician knew how to use leeches and how to use cups and how to administer other drugs, some drugs, and that's the way. And they were very useful. Of course, if things became serious, the technician advised to call the medical doctor. And Wickener was very much impressed. And in the Survey of Engineering Education, 1924 to 1932, a two-volume treatise, he devotes a considerable portion to the importance of training of technicians. I pulled out that volume when we got into the Second World War and tried to impress upon the universities and colleges, particularly the schools of engineering, that there is an opportunity to aid in the war effort by developing programs for the training of supporting personnel, particularly in engineering, in science, and in the area of management.
In a sense, then, this is the background of Purdue School of Technology and other similar programs at American universities.
That's the background. They've spread all over the country. But as I said before, the output is unfortunately very low, because the average American youngster wants to have a baccalaureate degree or a higher degree. And as a result of this, even Purdue University and a number of other institutions have set up programs which they call in technology, leading to a degree of Bachelor of Science in Technology, a curriculum that isn't as scientific as the curricula designed for the preparation of engineers, but which have quite little bit of science. They are more like the earlier curricula after the Moral and Grant Act was passed, giving considerable attention to skills in drafting and in using of tools and in operating equipment and things of that sort, and not going too far in advanced mathematics or too far in the sciences.
Is this the background of the program in the United States Air Force and Navy of taking the young men and giving them non-commissioned rank and making them technologists and looking with the little black boxes and so on? Is this the
I'm not certain that that had anything to do with it. Although I believe that there are people in the Department of Defense, acquainted as they are with programs in Europe, knew that again in continental Europe and in the British Isles, they did use a large number of people who were not commissioned officers but who were technicians, and they developed that. And particularly the Navy did a very good job in developing radio technicians and other kinds of technicians, and they performed very, very important services.
Well, we certainly have developed some sort of technology, haven't we? This moon, this trip to the moon is an interesting example of what we can
do. The trip to the moon, I mean, this whole program at Cape Kennedy is a combination of the work of the very best scientists, particularly physical scientists. To some extent, scientists in the biological and medical sciences. Engineers, particularly engineers who have had a strong science background, and also technicians. But I would say that the major job And I visited Cape Kennedy and they set up there a number of times. Is the job of engineers with a good scientific background, rather than of the technician.
I see.
Could have used technicians. There are a great many of the things that technicians would be useful. I think that that whole setup at Cape Kennedy is one of the most outstanding examples of what a cooperation between the top scientist, the engineer, the technician, and a skilled worker can do. It's breathtaking to see what great accomplishments. But they are not scientific accomplishments. They are not engineering accomplishments alone. But they are of the team, the scientific and technological team.
Now, may I turn to another subject? We have been talking about your experiences and your work in engineering and in education up to, we've been leading up to this. May I ask you to tell us how and why you came to Purdue and left Kansas State?
Well, actually, the person who attracted me to Purdue was W.E. Stone. W.E. Stone was a New Englander, very conservative, very scholarly, excellent judgment. I was impressed by him. I became dean at Kansas State in 1913, when I was just a little over 30 years old. And attending the meetings of the Association of Land Grant Colleges, I was impressed by Dr. Stone, his ability to analyze the situation. He was really a chemist. He was a food chemist. He was a graduate of the Amherst, of the Massachusetts Agricultural College, and he later on earned a doctor's degree in Germany. But he was a scholar, not only in the field of chemistry, but read very widely. He just was interested in all types of knowledge. He when Dr. Stone wrote me and told me that a committee of the faculty has been looking over the country for a successor to Dean C.H. Benjamin. Benjamin succeeded the first Dean of Engineering, W.F.M. Goss. Goss probably did more to build up engineering at Purdue than any person. Goss was the first person in the world to interest the railroads in carrying on experimentation that would improve the equipment used on that mode of transportation.
And he brought that experiment to Purdue.
And he brought that work to Purdue. Purdue was the first institution in the world to have a locomotive on wheels, on a stand with brakes, and it covered tens of thousands of miles without moving an inch. And
is this a locomotive that the old graduates talk about, how they'd have to tear it down, put it together again?
That's the one. And we had several locomotives, and Purdue became really the center of railroad research in the world. People were attracted to Purdue because of Goss. Goss himself was an unusual person. He was he never had much formal education. He graduated. He had a course. He was he lived on the Cape, you know, in Barnstable, Massachusetts, and learned that MIT has started a school to train technicians, a short course. It was a one-year course. I don't think he graduated high school, went near high school. He went to that course. And by the way, that course was responsible for some of the most prominent, the most successful alumni of MIT. When I attended my 25th reunion, I was impressed with the graduates of that Mechanics Institute, they called it. It was called the Mechanics Institute, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It was a short course, but it sparkled an interest in creativeness and things of that sort on the part of young people who were very competent in skills. You see, the average American farmer is very ingenious, and he can use his hands, and he can use tools. And so, of course, graduated from that school, then came to Purdue to teach shop work, as a teacher of shop work. While he was at Purdue, he studied by himself, received several honorary degrees, took 1 year's leave of absence, and instead of going to school, studied, used the libraries of Harvard and of MIT. If you had met Gauss, when I met him in the 1912, 13, 14, he was then Dean of Engineering at Purdue. He was a well-educated man. He had good manners. He had a very good background. And had a splendid personality. And I think that Gauss should be credited with a building at Purdue. I'm going to give you a letter that I wrote to one of our colleagues who was made the Gauss Professor of Engineering. So you'll get my views about Gauss. Now then, so Gauss, I think, was the one who suggested me to Dr. Stone. But he had a committee of the faculty study, and they wrote me and said that the committee of the faculty recommended he invite me to come as Dean of the Schools of Engineering. And I told him I'd like to look over. I told him I'm very happy where I am at Manhattan, Kansas. But the opportunities of being in a state, in an institution that serves industry, rather than a state like Kansas, an institution of Kansas State, interests me. He invited me to come here and deliver a lecture. I asked him whether I should give a talk on thermodynamics or power or the applications of engineering to agriculture. And I said, no. He says, you've been a student of so many things. He says, could you tell us something about Bolshevism and Menshevism and something about the movement which resulted in the recent revolution in Russia? And I gave a talk on that before the entire faculty. They tested me out. Then I told them I'm not interested in coming unless I was the choice of the major members of the engineering staff. I say, I knew Hatt, and I knew Harding, and I knew Young, and a number of others. And Jimmy Hoffman, who was professor at the University of Nebraska before he came here, when I was professor at Kansas State, I told him he would talk particularly to Hoffman, Young, Hatt, and Harding, and possibly Dukes, who was then head of mechanics. And Pfeffer, I didn't know. He was head of chemical engineering. And I said, if I have letters from them telling me what they expect me to do, what they expect, I say I may consider it. So within a very, very few days, I think Hatt was the first one who sent me a telegram to be followed by a letter. And I had letters and telegrams from each one of those people saying that they had discussed that thing with their colleagues in their particular departments. And it's the unanimous wish of the engineering faculty that I come to Purdue. So I told Stone that I'll come to Purdue. With that in case, I'll accept. But there are certain things I'd expect to change. I said, first of all, I said, if I'm to come as dean, instead of having every one of the immersive staff run to your office in order to get a pencil for a pencil that you had used up, or to keep people away from you. I said that my job would be to be a buffer so that the members of the staff will take up things with you through me. I say, secondly, I must have a budget.
You conceived your function of dean then,
yeah,
as one who represented your faculty to get things, yes, done for them.
And I told also Stone, I said, I'm not going to be just an administrator. I expect to have a professorship.
Right ahead.
And I said, I think you ought to discuss it with Harding and Young. I said, my field, I'm a cross between an electrical and a mechanical engineer. My interest really is in the power industry, in the electric power industry. And I said, I believe a professorship of power engineering would be more nearly what I want. I say, I expect if I come as dean to teach at least one undergraduate course and one graduate course, and then have a seminar for the teachers of engineering, could be for credit or not for credit, and also of graduate students, where we could discuss teaching problems. I'm not going to lecture to them, but it'll be sort of a forum where each one of us will work up certain things and discuss things. And so when I returned to Manhattan, Kansas, and told him that I told my wife that I accepted a position as Dean of Engineering at Purdue University, she says, is there a considerable difference in salary? I said, I never mentioned salary to Dr. Stone, and he didn't mention it to me. I have absolutely no idea, and I don't care. I said, I want to work with Stone. I didn't know what my salary was until I received my first paycheck. And Miss Brady, you know, Edna Brady, she was his stenographer, Miss Hunt was his secretary, and she says the president didn't realize it, that he had never mentioned salary, and didn't mention it to him. And that's where it started. Now Purdue at that time, when I came to Purdue, was a first-class institution. It probably lacked a certain amount of coordination and cooperation. Each one of the so-called schools went by itself. They worked their own program, they dealt with the president, and I felt, and I had the approval of not only of the heads of engineering departments, but of the entire engineering faculty, of my method of operation. I told them that my function is not that of a manager or boss, but that of coordinator. That I don't want an engineering faculty. The faculty should be by schools or departments. And the department is to discuss things, and then we'll have maybe one or two meetings a year where the various engineering departments will get together. I told them my job will be to sell things to you, things that the administration wishes to do, and to sell to the administration matters that are of particular interest to you as individuals and to Purdue as a center for engineering education and research. I told them that I was very much interested in research, and that that I expect a portion of my salary to come from research.
Is this where we started the Purdue Research Foundation? Is this the
That was later.
That was
we
later.
Had the Engineering Experiment Station.
I see. And you had had the engineering station at Kansas, so you knew pretty much what you wanted to do.
In fact, I was responsible for the first annealing legislation in connection with engineering experiment stations at the land-grant colleges. I was very much intrigued by the agricultural experiment stations. I think you probably heard me say, I feel that the Land Grant Act of 1862, called the Morrill Act, signed by Abraham Lincoln, was one of the most unusual and beneficial pieces of legislation in the interest of all education that have been enacted. First of all, it stressed the importance of education for use. You see, until the Land Grant Act was passed, American higher education was concerned very largely with things of the past, with a type of knowledge, type of education, which had nothing to do to enhance our agriculture, or to develop our industries, or to emphasize the importance of the home. And at the time of the war between the states, which we call Civil War, America was not a manufacturing nation. America was concerned largely with production of raw materials, of metals, and foodstuffs, and things of that sort, of lumber. And then those things were exported to other lands where they were manufactured into useful articles of commerce and then sold back to us at many times the cost of the raw materials. Our agriculture in 1862 was at a very low ebb, very low productivity. And the Morrill Land Grant Act emphasized the fact that while education should be broad enough to acquaint the student with the world about him, that they must neglect the humanities, that they must neglect interest in all types of knowledge, but that special attention should be given to the type of instruction which will be useful in upbuilding American agriculture, in developing American industry, and in improving the American home. And that was a wonderful thing, and that impressed me very much. Now then, since 1905, when I first went to the Kansas State Agricultural College, I was impressed the way those institutions were developed. The General Electric Company started its research laboratory the same year I came there. In fact, one of my professors, Willis Whitney, in chemistry, was the whole laboratory. He was the director part-time. He'd give 2 days a week to the General Electric Company, and the rest of the time to MIT as a teacher of chemistry. They felt that a part-time professor is enough for research. And at that time, in 1903, the land grant institutions like Purdue and Iowa State and Ames and Michigan State and so forth had well-developed research programs in agriculture. And not only as a result of the Hatch Act of the early 90s, and not only did they have effective programs of research, but they conceived the idea that, or they realized that research is useless unless you can use it, you can sell it. And they set up extension services through the various types of acts in the early 90s. In other words, more than 10 years I had the first laboratory at DuPont, which was started in 1902. The agricultural colleges of the land-grant institutions had well-developed, well-staffed organizations in research and in so-called extension, which sold the research to the farmer and to the others. So when I came to Purdue, I insisted that we should have a certain amount of money. I think they gave me $15,000 to set up for the engineering experiment station. And I insisted in giving me $5,000 for the first year to set up an extension service in engineering. And we called it engineering extension, with particular reference to highway engineering, so we could work very closely with the State Highway Commission, so we could work very closely with the state parks, which had as a director a very well-educated and German who was a man of vision and who really made the Indiana state parks. And I wanted to film that picture. And we had he had a so-called conservation department. And I sold Lieber, Richard Lieber, the idea that he should invite W.K. Hatt, head of, this, of civil engineering at Purdue, to be the director of the conservation department at no salary, that Purdue used to pay his, the part of his salary out of our engineering extension funds. And that brought about, in other words, when I came here, I was shocked to find that even in as highly industrialized a state as Indiana, that the engineering staff didn't know the industries of the state.
What were they teaching?
They were teaching, but they were teaching engineering, but they had no contacts with the industries. The first thing I did, I know I told you about it, I contacted Kimbrough. You see,
Who was he?
He was president of the Indiana Manufacturers Association,
and
also president of the Indiana Bridge Works.
Oh, where did he live? What was it?
He lived in Muncie.
In Muncie.
Muncie, Indiana, and he was a cousin of Emily Kimbrough. You know, he wrote those interesting books. Kimbrough gave me the first $3,000 to start a personnel system. I told Kimbrough when I first came here that in 1905, when I went to the Kansas State Agricultural College, that I was so greatly impressed with the farm boys who were my students, but I felt that there are certain traits of certain mannerisms, certain habits that ought to be polished up. I felt then, as I do more and more now, that the person's positions in life depends partly on what he knows, but a good deal more on whom he knows and what people think of him. And I sold to the president of Kansas State Agricultural College the idea that it is our responsibility when a student enters the college to help him in developing habits. I told the president, all of us are bundles of habits. Some of our habits may be classed as character, the question of integrity, the question of real cleanliness. Other habits we class as personality, such as address and manner and dress and cooperative ability and things of that sort. And I prepared a list of things that I thought would be well if we had the student analyze himself and we had the teachers work with him in analyzing. And I'll show you later the kinds of blanks that I developed at that time. I don't want to take the time of this tape to discuss it. Now, when I came to Purdue, as I said, in 1920, J.L. Kimbrough, president of the Manufacturers Association, by reason of the fact that he employed a Kansas State graduate in his organization, knew of my personnel system. And he gave me $3,000. And that was matched by the Indiana Manufacturers Association. He gave me a personal check of $3,000. And we started the Purdue personnel system, which the alumni of the classes of 1920 to the time we went in the Second World War felt had a very important part in preparing them, particularly for the management and other top posts which so many of them hold. So there is the situation. Now, I think I have it here somewhere, those personnel blanks that I can show you. That's right here. This is the way, that's the thing that I worked up, and I took it to the president of the Kansas State College in June 1905.
Oh, yes, well.
You remember it?
No, I've never seen it before. However, those who've looked at it certainly will.
Now, this is the first blank card I prepared that we had as a record. We'd ask the student to rate himself. First of all, we ask the student to make out this,
yes,
to the best of his ability,
yes, mm-hmm,
to discuss it with his friends,
yes,
with his minister, with some of the others. Then we had a blank like this, made out by him and by others. It was never given to anybody, except to the student.
Yes.
That's what Jack Warabot and
Jack
Walters.
It's what people call a personnel audit.
Personnel audit.
Did Jack Walters, did Jack Walter, you better keep this, I might lose it. Did Jack Walters...
No, I lend it to you because I have respect for you.
Well, thank you, sir, but
let me give you
I don't want to lose these.
Well, I give you some other stuff.
No, I think I'd rather have you keep this right here.
No, I'd rather, you go ahead.
Very good.
You'd be interested. I had to use, I learned English. I learned a good deal by working out this. I took the dictionary and I worked out this before I took it to President Nichols, that physicist, you know, who was president of Kansas State Agricultural College, and he was a fellow also after my heart.
Well, now, let's get back to Purdue. You did all this in 1920 and 21, then, just after...
1921, the first year.
What did you do with the curriculum of Purdue? Did you make any changes in the courses in themselves?
My philosophy of management is never to put a person on defensive, but to sell them. And I sold my colleagues, I told them that I've always felt that the most important subject for a young person in school is to develop ability to express himself clearly, correctly, and forcibly in his mother tongue. That the requirement of 1 year of English, which we had, which was largely composition, is absolutely insufficient. And before I'd been here more than 2 months, the engineering faculty proposed to the general faculty that all curricula be required to have 1 year, 2 years of English instead of 1 year. With the amount of composition to depend on the student's preparation. Some may need a semester, some may need none. But that the course, the English, but also that the student should have at least 1 semester of oral English, which is speech. That, but at least a year should be devoted to English literature. And I've always been interested in English literature and other literature. Another thing that I sold them was that we ought to learn something about our human mind. That every engineering student should have at least a semester's exposure to psychology.
Now this was part of the engineering curriculum when I first came to Purdue.
It was part.
After World War II.
Yes, it was there for many years. And then it was thrown out. I also felt that the student should know particularly the history of his own country. And that again should be by test. If he has had a good preparation in American history, he might take some other history. But he should have preferably a year or possibly a semester of history. I was not so particular about languages, because it was immediately after the First World War, where people were very suspicious of German or of any other foreign language. So I didn't stress that. I also felt that a course in economics, partly as a result of my own experience, because I had such a very happy time with Professor Davis Dewey. I think I told you about it, who was brother of Admiral Dewey.
Yes, you did.
And I thought that student ought to have at least a year of economics. Learn something even about economic theory and things of that sort. And and I had no difficulty. Probably the person who was most helpful to me in that thing was W.K. Hatt, head of the Civil Engineering Department, school they called it. Professor Hatt read French well, even could speak it a little. He was interested in books. I had very little difficulty in selling it to him. I had very little difficulty in selling it to Harding, who was a graduate of the Worcester Polytechnic Institute, had had a career with Stoner Webster during their early days, and was really a very well-educated and cultured New Englander. He went along with me. Pfeffer, who was head of chemical engineering, came here from industry. He had very little background. He was a superintendent of one of the plants of one of the chemical companies in St. Louis. He was a little more difficult to sell. Dukes, who was in charge of mechanics, was another one of my very strong supporters, because Dukes enjoyed literature, I think, ever bit as much as Dr. Stoner Wright did. Dukes and Stoner and I, instead of discussing the problems at Purdue, would always discuss some of the reading we were doing. We'd always, Stoner always say, what are you reading now? And we would just constantly be the same with Dukes. And I had a very easy time. I had a very easy time, but I didn't do it by telling them, but I'd sell them. I always was allergic to committees. I never liked to serve in committees, and I never liked to ask anybody else to serve in committees. I felt I could do better by just walking over to a person's office and discuss it with him and ask him to give some thought to it. Now I'll go to somebody else. If you'll pardon me for saying so, I don't think I ever asked anybody, told anybody to come over to my office to see me. I'd go over to sell them. If something was wrong, I'll try to find out some of the good things that that particular professor did, and I'll drop in and tell him I was so glad I met such and such a student, and he told me how much he enjoyed his class and how much he's getting out for them. And then I'd slowly bring around to the fact there's been some misunderstanding about him in connection with such a thing he did or didn't do, or things of that sort. I want to look it over and let's talk it over again. Maybe we can stop the spread of that kind of rumors. And I got along better with them. They remember, I sold my staff to the fact that I am their servant, I'm not any more in love with Purdue than they are, and that we're working something together. I've had a little different experience. I'm going to give them the benefit of my experience. And I had a very easy time to sell curricula. And when it came to staff, you see, how did I build up the staff again? I felt it's the responsibility of the engineering faculty, the faculties of different departments, to fill vacancies. I would suggest, if they asked me to, if they say, here, Professor so-and-so is taking a new position at the University of Michigan, whom do you think we should approach? And I'd say, well, in my contacts, I met Erickson, Leif Erickson at the University of Michigan, who is teaching mechanics then. He's a Scandinavian, he came from Denmark, pressed me very favorably as a man and as a family man, as I was at his home. His wife was very attractive. And I said, Professor Hatt, supposing you go down to Michigan and sort of look him up. And then someone, but the recommendation had to come from the faculty of the particular department or school. And I usually would like to see the person if it's in a position of assistant professor or higher. And then, when I approved it, I'd prepare a memorandum for the president saying that acting on the recommendation of the civil engineering or electrical or whatnot, that the vacancy of so-and-so, for the vacancy of so-and-so, they recommend so-and-so. And here are his high points, that I'd interviewed him, that we had him here, and I recommend that their recommendation be approved. That's the way we handle it. And we'd always bring down a person here and bring down his wife. And it was a little expense, but it was worth it. And when Elliot, Dr. Elliot, when he first came here, I thought it was unnecessary. I thought it was necessary for him to see the setup here and the various people to see him. And I said the expenditure of a few thousand dollars a year in connection with the selection of men would produce results. And he was with me on it. He agreed. And the thing that is a happy memory to me over the 33 years I was here as dean was help I received from my colleagues. We had a wonderful time together. Of course, they laughed at my ideas of holding. I used to have a meeting. If you had a meeting of the heads of the engineering departments, it was usually at 11 o'clock in the morning. And by 11:45, most of us got a little bit uncomfortable, so we couldn't stay too long. I didn't like people to have long committee meetings. No committee meetings nights. No committee meetings after 4 o'clock. That was an understanding. I didn't order it. But I would just raise the question whether we wouldn't save time if we scheduled meetings at 11 o'clock so we wouldn't be just talking. And have people come prepared to a committee meeting so we can button it up quickly. That was the situation. Also, thanks.
Well, on curriculum, is there anything more that you can think of? Is there anything more in the area of curriculum? Did you supervise the curriculum of each school? For example, someone come to you with a proposal to change the curriculum, let us say in the School of Chemical Engineering or in the School of Mechanical Engineering. Did you talk that over with the people in charge?
Definitely. I'd meet with the faculty of the school and I'd meet with individuals. Of course, I didn't sell my ideas. My idea, as I look back, I'm not at all satisfied with success. I always felt that the curriculum in engineering or in agriculture or in home economics, the areas of the land-grant college, like all goals, should be made up of three parts. That one-third should be devoted to sciences and mathematics. One-third should be devoted to general studies, languages, history, economics, philosophy, psychology, other general studies. And that one-third be devoted to the engineering, including the specialized branch.
No.
I was definitely of the opinion that there should be no differentiation, or very little differentiation, in engineering education during the first 2 years, and preferably during the first 3 years. But I received great opposition, particularly from chemical engineering. It took me 10 years to get the chemical engineers to approve a uniform freshman year. 10 years. And thanks to people like Harry Solbach and D.D. Ewing, that I was able to accomplish it even then. I wanted to have the curricula a very little change.
Well, now, sir, what I noticed is this, that compared to the catalogs of years in the past, before World War I, I noticed one great change. There's less time spent in soldering, molding, and working in the shop after World War I than there was before. Was this due to you?
No. I think that's as our American industry grew, they realized that the engineer should be utilized better than he was in the past. When I graduated from MIT in 1903, all of the young engineers had to serve a certain amount of time in the shop. It would be put right beside skilled mechanics to operate machine tools, and they judged him by the way his boss, the machinist, thought he did. They would put him in the drafting room. Every engineer served in the drafting room a certain period. And in order to be marketable upon graduation, the engineering graduate had to have considerable skill in drafting, sketching, and tools, surveying, and things of that sort. And the development started really before the First World War. I saw it coming beginning about 1910, where emphasis on shop work was being decreased. Personally, I'm convinced that we did wrong during the last 15 or so years by practically eliminating all skills. A person today can graduate in civil engineering without knowing how to use a surveying instrument. To me, a civil engineer is somebody who knows how to use a transit and level. And surveying was a wonderful subject to teach people accurate record keeping and instrumentation. Vassar College, which was the first women's college, had a required course in surveying for all the girls, because the people who were responsible for the opening of Vassar realized the value of surveying. They didn't try to make surveyors, but they learned a good deal about instrumentation. They learned a good deal about orderly bookkeeping and orderly taking of notes. And they learned to work with others. And I think the mistake that has been made since the Second World War is the fact that we have gone too rapidly in increasing the amount of scientific and mathematical and other theoretical preparation, and decreasing too rapidly the amount of applied. And that discouraged large numbers of students from entering engineering colleges. As a matter of fact, the enrollment in undergraduate engineering college today isn't any better than it was 15 or 20 years ago. And that's due to the fact that the average person who is interested in tools and machines and processes gets discouraged, where he finds that he has to spend so much of his time in abstract subjects.
Such as solid state physics.
Pardon me?
Such as solid state physics.
But another thing that has happened that has been very detrimental to the country, about 16 years ago, an engineer from one of the manufacturing companies, said that that technology is growing so rapidly that an engineer 7 years out of school is absolutely obsolete, probably 5 years. What he meant was that any professional man must keep up with his profession. That the medical people that are prominent are constantly attending conferences and schools and doing a great deal of reading and study in order to keep up to date. And that if a person, if a professional person, whatever his calling is, stops studying and stops keeping up to date, he gets into a rut. And the difference between a rut and a grave is one of dimensions and outlets. And that statement did an enormous amount of harm. I sat not so long ago beside the principal of the largest high school in Detroit. And in mid-conversation I said, you have a large number of your students going as opposed to study engineering at the University of Michigan and Michigan State. We have had quite a few at Purdue. He said, in recent years we have not encouraged our better pupils to think of engineering as a profession. He says, who wants to encourage a young person to go into a profession where a few years after graduation he'll be obsolete and out of a job? And that's what's happening. But the engineering curricula, as I look at the curriculum at Purdue when I came here in 1920, it was good. It was anything but mediocre. Of course, changing times. We had not heard of nucleonics or anything of that sort. And naturally, the changed conditions. The reason we have to, the curriculum required the strengthening of the sciences. Now you think even the time I retired from Purdue in 1953, much less than 5% of the engineers of the country were employed by government and were concerned with research and development. Most of the engineers were concerned with design, construction, operation, technical management, and things of that sort. Now, more than a third of the engineers are working in research and development and on the government payroll rather than the payrolls of a corporation. And even in corporations, the amount of research being carried on by engineers and under the supervision of engineers has grown so rapidly that the engineer of today must be better prepared in mathematics and particularly the physical
science. Is this due to the influence of schools such as MIT and Caltech? Now, you hear ordinarily that Purdue trains people who can keep the machines running. But if you want a man to do research and you want a man in industry who will think and plan, you don't go to Purdue, you go to MIT.
I don't know. That's a statement made by people who don't know anything about it.
I'm glad to hear it.
The only institution which was more nearly right was Caltech. Caltech doesn't have any presidents of companies or any top people of industries like MIT or Purdue has. But it's really uncanny. The number of people who are in top positions. You take a company like Ingersoll Rand. I had something to do with them recently. And the chairman of the board is a graduate in mechanical engineering in the class of 42. No, he's a graduate in electrical engineering in the class of 36. The president is a graduate from Purdue in mechanical engineering in 42. President of the Westinghouse, a graduate from Purdue University in 36, and so forth. It's uncanny, the percentage. More than two-thirds of the graduate of Purdue, and I don't think the percentage is any higher at MIT, it's about the same, are in management, top management positions.
I would say the
amount of so-called practical training at Purdue during the last 50 years was not very different from what it is at MIT. I think today MIT has a somewhat larger portion, a larger number of graduate students. MIT ranks first in the number of PhDs it gives. I think Purdue runs fourth, third or fourth. But there isn't too much difference. I was at MIT on the 27th of this month. I spent a day there talking to chairman of the board, Jim Killian, some of the others.
You are a trustee, aren't you, at MIT?
Or no, you have been? I was in there on the visiting committee.
Visiting committee.
And for many years, visiting committees in mechanical engineering and also in electrical engineering. You see, they consider me both an electrical and mechanical engineer. Actually, don't make much difference. I used to tell the parents of prospective students, what they asked me what branch of engineering, I told them, throw a coin. One takes one and one takes the other. Don't make much difference.
As long as they can think.
And
you regard Purdue teaching people to think as engineers. Can you do that in 4 years?
Some people you can never teach that. Actually, some people can think when they graduated high school. Learn to think in high school. And it isn't a question of years. It isn't at all a question of years. You take some of the top people, even in government. You take Bundy, you know. Harper's has a very interesting, last issue of Harper's has a very interesting, what's his name,
McGeorge Bundy.
Bundy,
mm-hmm.
He never took any graduate work. He's a bachelor from Harvard. And you take Gardner, who was probably one of the best heads of the Office of Education, don't you know, Commissioner of Education. He has a bachelor's degree from some institution, never took any graduate. It isn't the number of years. It isn't the number of years at all. Killian, who was president of MIT and is now chairman of his board, and the first advisor that the President of the United States had, Eisenhower, scientific advisor, they used to refer to Killian as the great scientist. Why Killian isn't a scientist, isn't an engineer? He graduated at MIT in course 9, which was a general course by students who didn't think that they had enough ability to get some of the advanced mathematics and didn't particularly care for physical sciences, and Pat is a person who can think and who can judge.
Well, now while we're at this, teaching people to think, and you say it's a matter of the individual, there is a certain stamp and character, however, that many engineering schools will talk about. I met a man from Rice, who said
Rice
in Houston, Texas.
Excellent.
And he said, we take only the very best students, and we teach them how to think. We prepare them in the background of work that they will use, and then when they graduate, they can go into almost any area, but they've been well prepared in mathematics, physics, and in the problems of engineering. Now, I've talked to others who will say the same thing, and then I say, well, how does Purdue fit in? Well, they say Purdue and Illinois are two large state universities providing us with men who are mainly section chiefs and bosses. And, well, you know this line of thought. Okay. Is there any difference in good engineering education in any of our leading engineering schools?
Well, I tell you, Rice and Caltech, and a few students like these, students like that, have been very careful in these admission procedures. They do accept the best graduates of high schools.
But we can't do
but
that.
But wait a moment. By the end product, how many Rice graduates are presidents of companies or directors of research with large research? How many in the space program are graduates of Rice or of Caltech? You take Armstrong. He's a scientist. A damn good one, too. I remember Armstrong when he was in school and as a freshman when I was still dean. And he had a personality, he had a very likable personality, and that helped him. But that's all stuff said by people who don't know. Illinois has done a wonderful job. So has Purdue. So has Michigan. So I have a great many others. This country is fortunate in not having the best institution and the next one and two, three of us and the others. We have 200 or so institutions giving instruction in engineering. There are at least 25 that are first class. You take the little school here in our own state, Rose Polytechnic Institute. It's a wonderful institution. One of its graduates in recent years was president of the AT&T system and chairman of its board. His name was Leroy Wilson. They've had a wonderful record of its alumni. It's poorly supported. In fact, they don't get any state support. And the same with state institutions. It's remarkable what graduates of state institutions did. Illinois, Minnesota, Purdue, Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a remarkable record.
There are two engineering schools in Michigan, University of Michigan, Michigan State. See? Are they both good in their respective areas?
Of course, Michigan State has grown more rapidly. Michigan State is more human, more democratic. They had one of the greatest presidents in Hanna. Hanna was a poultry man, not particularly well educated, but a humanist who knew how to attract people, how to work with people. And Michigan State, I think, is larger than Michigan now. But Michigan has had a good record. I wouldn't say the record of the University of Michigan is any better than that of Illinois.
We're talking about engineering, of course.
And engineering, frankly, it's a very difficult thing today. Stanford has had an unusually strong program in the area of communication. You see, electrical communication.
I wasn't aware of this.
I would put Stanford way ahead of Purdue or MIT or any of those.
Is that so?
Ohio State has done a wonderful job in so many areas. Ceramics. They really made the ceramic industry of this country. Purdue made distinctive contributions in a variety of fields. Frankly, in the electric power industry, I think Purdue probably stands out. I think that we're ahead of MIT in that.
You think you had something to do with it?
I don't know. But the field of heat transfer, there's Minnesota, Purdue. I would say we're better in Illinois or MIT. You know, it's the individual. In materials, for many years, Illinois was tops. Then a member named of Talbot. That's a thing that people at large and even the governing boards of educational institutions don't realize. That the teacher, the individual, can affect eternity. And that an institution might have one teacher who might make the institution. Rose Polytechnic Institute, I heard of Rose before I heard I could spell Purdue. When I was a junior at MIT, Alexander Gray was one of the great authorities in telephony of that time, early telephony. And I heard of Professor Gray of the Rose Polytechnic Institute at Troy. When it came to materials, there was a professor at Rose, I just this minute forget his name.
Rosa Rensselaer.
Huh?
Rosa Rensselaer.
Rose Polly.
Rose Polly, down in Terre Haute.
At Terre Haute. Mm-hmm. Professor Gaetano Lanza, head of the mechanical engineering department, who was himself a materials man, referred to Professor Sanso at Rose. who was doing probably the best work in material testing. When I came to Purdue, I once seen the laboratory of that professor. It was in Terre Haute in a sub-cellar without a floor. We had there a testing machine. He did some very unusual work. So when you're speaking of education, of course, if people only realize that, it's the individual. It's the individual. Particularly if that individual, besides being an innovator, loves people and is sensitive to human values, so he can sell himself and his ideas to his students. We had here at Purdue an individual in physics who was probably one of the most gifted and would have been as a Nobel Prize winner without question many, many years ago, who was probably more responsible for some of the developments of the last 20 years in communication than anyone in this country. But his personality was such that people couldn't work with him. That's the thing that's prompted me when I went as a youngster to the General Electric Company, is to develop a personnel system. I feel that the success of an individual in his calling, whether he's in a profession or any other calling, depends on how he gets along with people, what people think of him. An individual may be ever so bright, if he rubs people the wrong way, he's not going to get anywhere. The position which we occupy in life, doctor, depends on our friends. Unless a person has the character and to an ability to attract, develop, and keep friends, he's not going to get very far. As I look over my own career, such little successes I had was due largely to my friends who were always working for me and trying to do something for me. It wasn't through my ability, I had very ordinary abilities, but they encouraged me to utilize those ordinary talents. And so it's rather naive to say that an institution like Rice, because it has strict entrance requirements and is a private institution, has attracted some rather outstanding people mentally, has been more successful. I wouldn't put him at all in the same class as Rose Polly or Rensselaer Polly or a good many other institutions.
Well, you've answered the question. I wanted to get your views on it, and you've answered it very adequately. One of the things that I think would be interesting, could you take a moment and discuss, if you wish, the kind of administration from where you sat that you had for 33 years from the trustees? Would you like to talk about that?
Yes.
Or not?
I can. Of course, Purdue has been very fortunate in the trustees. At least I knew nearly all the trustees for nearly 50 years of Purdue. I would put at the top of all David E. Ross, who was the greatest benefactor of Purdue. The success of President Eliot as president may be traced largely to the advice and encouragement he received from David E. Ross.
Well, now may I ask one question that I've heard raised? Eliot made use of the Depression and Depression financing to build so many of our buildings. Did Ross encourage him? In what sense did Ross help build Purdue physically? Of course, we have the Ross Aid Stadium and so on. But was it his contribution mainly in encouraging the building of buildings, or was it in other areas, or
I
both?
Ross should be credited for his vision. Most of the great buildings here were definitely plan by Ross. When I first came to Purdue and he was a young trustee, a new trustee, the first thing he asked me was, why don't you get one of your professors to make a plan for the campus so we can work to something? He says, we have now appropriation for two buildings from the legislature, one for a home economics building and one for a recitation building. Where are we going to put them? He says, nobody had planned. And I said, we have a young man by the name of George Lama, who is a great teacher. But from what I talked to him, he has an appreciation of this sort of thing you're talking about. And he said, what can we do to make him available? I said, if you pay his salary during the summer, if you'll arrange for Purdue to make available money for salary during the summer. That was the summer when President Stone died, see? I think we can have a plan. And the campus of today is the plan worked out by George Lama. He said to me one day, I mean, I'm telling you those things to give you an idea. He says, what worries you? I said, the power plant of Purdue. He says, you know, I'm a power plant man. I said, we have an antiquated power plant with fire tube boilers that are becoming obsolete. We have a Chandler and Taylor engine. We have a couple of reciprocating engines. The electricity shut off at 4 o'clock. If anybody wants to work on the campus evenings, they can't come on the campus because during a considerable portion of the year it's dark. I said we have insufficient electricity in the buildings to really do the work, which not only engineering but all the departments of the university ought to be doing, particularly in research. And I said we ought to have a new power plant. And I say I'll help you design a plant. I say I'll design the plant with the assistance of some of my students, with some of my colleagues. I said, I have enough close association with Stoner Webster and with the other people in the power industry that I can have their advice without the cost of 1 cent to Purdue about our plans. I said, I have enough contract with Babcock and Wilcox and General Electric and Foster Wheeler and other companies. I know I can get donations or at least discounts on equipment. I said, if you could get the legislature to appropriate $200,000 to make a start, or for the governor to turn it over to you, they'll make a start. I said, but before doing this, I'm going to appoint a committee consisting of Professor G. Young and Professor Harding, G. Young in mechanical, Harding in electrical, to work with me and make an appraisal of the thing so that what I told you be facts rather than just my own opinion. We prepared such a report and turned it over to Mr. Ross. We had no president then. Coulter was chairman of the faculty. Marshall was acting president.
This is the Marshall of mathematics.
No, sir. This is the Marshall who was editor of the Journal Courier. And it was probably the most successful politician Indiana had.
Very good.
And we designed that power plant. And the people to whom I would give credit for the design of the power plant would be Harry L. Solberg, who was a young graduate of South Dakota Agricultural College. They came down here to get a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, another bachelor's degree, and later on in graduate work. He was a very great help to me. And also George King, who was professor of machine design, an alumnus of Purdue University with some experience. And after we designed it, Sobert, King and Potter. I took the design to Stoner Webster. I told Stoner Webster that I have no authority from the administration of Purdue. Purdue is without the president. I have no money to pay. But would it be possible for Stoner Webster to glance through those plans and make suggestions? And Stoner Webster said, why? You know our chief engineer is with you on the Prime Movers Committee. You can have all the time of his that you want. He'll come down to Lafayette and spend a couple of weeks with you and work with you. And we had a design. Then I started in with manufacturers. I contacted Babcock and Wilcox. I told them we'll start with two boilers. Will they give us one boiler and we'll pay for one? I did the same thing with General Electric. We designed it with turbines. I said I wanted two 500 kilowatt turbines. We'll pay for one and they should give us one. And I had a list of the of potential donations, which I took to Dave Ross and Mr. Marshall. Just about that time, Elliot was appointed president. And Elliot came here, he had never heard of Stoner Webster, there in Montana, but he had a company from Minneapolis who designed a power plant for the University of Montana. He wanted to hire that company to check it out. And they were going to charge him $8,000. And Dave Ross asked me what I think of it. I said, well, I'm not going to say anything about it, but I'll help. If they come here, I'll help them. He knew that Stoner Webster checked it and helped us a good deal with it. We got through the report and they got the $8,000. I told Ross that I wrote that report with the assistance of Harry Solberg and King. And they didn't know. They didn't have any appreciation of some of those things. I had lots of trouble with Elliot when we were building that power plant. He knew nothing about it, but he was making it difficult, don't you see? But we got that power plant in shape and running for not much more than the $200,000.
That's amazing. Now that is the old power plant.
And it's still running.
Yes, it is.
It's still working. They couldn't get the new plant to work, so they're still using the old one.
What's the trouble with the new plant?
I don't know. I purposely don't keep in touch with things since
very
I retired.
Very good.
Elliot was fine, but he had those ideas, don't you see?
Let's go back to Ross. I don't think you told me half enough about Ross.
Ross was a polygon of talents. He was a successful farmer. Even during the bad years of the World Depression, Ross made money on his farm. He was an inventor. He was constantly trying to find new ways of doing things. He was a bachelor. He fell in love with Purdue University in 1899. And he never needed any wife or children or anything of that sort. That was his first love. Dave Ross came from Brookston. I don't think he had any high school education, or very little.
There's a biography of Mr. Ross that I read.
Yes, not a too good a one. It's by Kelly.
Yes.
It wasn't too good. It doesn't give credit to Ross. Ross was a much better man than that biography said. He was a Benjamin Franklin, in a sense, of Indiana. He was a humanist. He loved people. He got along well with people. People worked for him. I was embarrassed with his generosity. One time I said to him, now, the diesel engine is becoming more and more important in the American power industry, and Purdue don't have a diesel engine. In no time at all. I had a distinguished laboratory for me. When aeronautics, interest in aeronautics was started, every institution was trying to build a bigger wind tunnel than the other one. MIT built a certain size wind tunnel, and Michigan built a bigger one, and California built a bigger one still, and so forth. And Ross talked to me about it, and he wanted to know whether we should try to get some help from industry or from somebody in building a real big wind tunnel. I told him, you can't learn too much from size there. That are built, the type of wind tunnels we have there are mostly made by our own staff and students. Those are now for principals. I said, what I'd like to see is to have some institution have a flying field within walking distance of the campus, where we could carry on tests on real planes, find out the effect, for instance, of elevation on temperature, effect of elevation on the operation of certain things, and so forth. It wasn't more than a few days. He came over one day, came over to my office, and he says, how busy are you? I said, I'm never busy to help. And he says, let's take a ride. I want to show you something. He showed me the place where he says there was an option on this land where the airport is located. He says, I'll buy it and give it to Purdue if you think that's what you want. I said, I think it's exactly what I want. I said, but what I'll do, I'll take it up with my colleagues. I'll call together the major members of the engineering faculty, and I'll call you back tomorrow. Another time, he wanted to see me, and I was out of town. I was visiting the summer surveying camp in northern Michigan. When I came back, I told him I am disgusted to have a surveying camp that far away. I said that that we should have a surveying camp right within easy driving distance of Lafayette. Again, a few days later, he called me up and he said, if you're not too busy, I'm going to take you for a little ride. He showed me that site. He says, I'm going to buy it. I want my home on this section, and I'll buy this section for a surveying camp for Purdue. And he paid for the cost of the land, he pays for the buildings. And that surveying camp served its purpose. We don't need it anymore. You see, we don't train surveyors. But it's used now for the agricultural, you know, the boy, what do you call it, boy? The
4-H?
4-H clubs.
Yes.
And it was that way. In fact, I was embarrassed. I was, he was a wonder. I used to see him at least, he'd call me over a couple times a week. I told him I'll not talk on matters that involve university policy. I say, let's have an agreement. If it's anything that's related to Purdue, except some dreams that you and I may want to explore, I said, I'd rather do it in the presence of the president of Elliott. And I will not talk to you about salaries or shortages of staff or things of that sort. I'll do those things through Elliott. And Elliott agreed. He says, he don't mind for him to call me anytime. And we talk about inventions, some of Ross's ideas. We talk about that. We dream about Purdue. What we thought Purdue ought to strive. And one of those dreams resulted, I talked to him about Kettering and about Willis Whitney, the director of the General Electric Research Laboratories, who was my teacher of chemistry. And I was a man of vision in industrial research. I talked to him about some of the equipment at the University of Michigan and at the and of the Westinghouse laboratories, where the top of it, the top men was a Purdue alumnus, and of U.S. Steel. So I'd like to see some of those things. He says, could you arrange to take me on a tour of inspection and you find out let me see those things. He said, I'll pay all expenses. And I said, no, Mr. Ross, that's something you ought to take up with President Elliott. A few days later, Elliott asked me to come over to Ross's office. I told Ross, where do you want me to meet you? He says, I'm going to the auto show in New York. And I said, all right, I'll meet you in New York at the auto show. I want you to see a few plays in New York. Did you ever see many plays on Broadway? Did you ever see Grand Opera? I say it'll cost you a few dollars, but it's I want you to see what New York has. So I'd like to spend with you a few days first looking over those things. Then we'll go to institutions in New York, such as Columbia. I want you to meet Nicholas Murray Butler, the builder of Columbia. I know him. I know the Pigram, who is the Dean of Engineering, later on was Vice President of Columbia. And I said, I want you to go to the Stevens Institute of Technology, which is probably one of the finest engineering schools in the world, and which really was responsible for the founding of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers and other things. I want you to see my classmate, Frank Jewett, who is the head of the Bell Laboratories, and to spend at least a day with Jewett and his staff to see research. So then, I'll make an arrangement with Willis Whitney to see the General Electric Laboratories. Then we're going to visit Kettering in General Motors. We're going to see General Motors Laboratories. And as a result of that, there is something that I'll lend it to you, but there is something that I must get back because there is no other copy.
I don't like to take any of these things from the office.
Could you stop that for a minute?
Yes, certainly. Just a second. The tape will now stop. We are now back on the tape. During the time the tape was stopped, Dean Potter showed me a report that he made to the president of a trip that he and Mr. Ross took to engineering schools and to companies in the East for the purposes of affecting Purdue's development and education. I'd like to ask you this question now, because it comes right in line with it, about the founding of the Purdue Research Foundation and David Ross, the part he played in.
I'm going to give you a copy of a memorandum that I had prepared for Dean Hawkins, which exactly answers this thing, and I have copies of it, and I can give you a copy. What? But definitely, that trip, when we returned from that trip, Mr. Ross requested J.K. Lilly, who was head of the Eli Lilly Company, Mr. J.L. Kimbrough, who was a very prominent member of the Board of Trustees, and Simpson, who was a horticulturist and a representative of agriculture and a very high-grade Hoosier. And he asked me to take those people to some of the places that Mr. Ross and I went to.
Yes.
Which I did. And the trip with Mr. Ross, supplemented by the trip under the leadership of J.K. Lilly, were responsible for the Purdue Research Foundation. But in order that you may have a complete statement without taking too much of your time right here on the tape, I shall give you that letter. I'll find a copy of that letter and give it to you when we meet next.
That's fine. But I want to be clear, as a result of the trip that you and David Ross took, and then a second trip, the Purdue Research Foundation came from this. Now,
correct.
This came through the trustees, the establishment.
Came through the trustees, and has been most beneficial in developing not only the graduate program of Purdue and its research activities, but also in performing a large number of services which Purdue could not have carried on as a state institution.
Now this, in other words, is what, in a sense, what Purdue has done is to have had this established, and much of it was done by a grant, and do I understand this correctly, a grant of stock from the from David Ross?
David Ross in the Fairfield Manufacturing Company and in the Ross Gear. Actually, the contributions of Ross to Purdue University, I'm of the opinion, exceeded $3 million.
$3 million.
It exceeded. But I don't know how much. I have no accurate statements. But from what I've observed, I'm of the opinion it's probably nearer $5 million than $3 million.
But this is the time that the Purdue Research Foundation, started in when? What year?
1927.
But the genesis of it was in the trip in the
Europe. Yeah.
What other qualities did Ross have, and what other things did he do besides this?
He was interested in public matters. Mm-hmm. He was interested in beautifying the part of the Wabash River which joins East Lafayette and West Lafayette. He was very active on the council of the city of Lafayette, Indiana. He was constantly giving of his time and means to the community in order to improve the community. That whole area of the so-called levee was a slum, and it was improved largely through the efforts of Dave Ross. Another thing about Dave Ross, he was a source of great inspirational value insofar as students and staff are concerned. Any staff member or student could go over to Dave Ross and see him. He didn't have to call up and make an appointment or anything of that sort. If he wasn't busy, he saw him. He told me as early as 1923 or 4, if you have a young man who has an idea which you think may be patentable, you let me know and I'll pay all of the expenses for the youngster to get a patent, and the patent belongs to him. I would send numerous of my graduate students and some undergraduates to his office to consult Ross about inventions. Really, I think, as I look back over the past 49 years, Dave Ross was the greatest man and most useful man I've known.
Well, that is a great tribute to Mr. Ross. And for the record, I am delighted that this has been made. Now, tomorrow, or in the next time we have an interview, we'll start with the trustees and your experience with them, and before we go to other matters.
All right.
Well, this is the end of our interview on July 17th, and it's the end of tape number 2.